Go into our passage this evening for 1 Kings chapter 6. A house like no other. Solomon has undertaken one of the greatest building projects of all time. He's begun construction on the temple, and we're looking into the descriptions that were given of it. There are two places in the Bible where we are given descriptions of the temple. One is here in 1 Kings chapter 6. The other is in 1 Chronicles chapter 3. We're going to do a little bit of comparison there. In many regards, the texts are the same. They're sort of like the Gospels, where you get a very complementary view of things going between the two books. But they do differ in some of the details. It helps us understand. I've got the picture thrown up here so that you can get an idea of what the temple looked like in its construction. And I'll just remind you again that anytime you see pictures like this, this is an artist's conception. It's probably close, but it doesn't mean this is exactly what the temple looked like. Okay, we showed you another temple mount, and let me bring that one up. We showed you this picture and said that might be an accurate representation, except that the actual structure back here in the back isn't big enough. The dimensions given to us in this passage are very clearly much longer. They are 90 feet long, not just looks like 20 feet there. So I think this picture is interpreting the entire, the dimensions as describing the entire temple complex, and that just the Holy of Holies is what's shown back here. But that probably is not the way it is. I think this other one represents the picture of what it might have looked like just a little bit better. Gene? Yeah, this would be something what Solomon's temple may have looked like. But once again, we're looking at artists' renditions. You have to look at the Hebrew text and to understand what's going on, but they don't always describe things in the Hebrew text quite the way that we would build a blueprint for a building today. And so sometimes it's a little difficult to reconstruct what the actual structure looked like. For one thing, when they're giving dimensions of the building, and they say that the building was 20 cubits wide, are they giving the exterior dimension, or are they giving the interior dimension, or are they sort of giving like a center-to-center dimension? Because obviously that number can't include the walls, because we're going to read at one point the whole building was 20 cubits wide, but the inner sanctuary, the Holy of Holies, was 20 cubits wide. So we're either talking about from the center of the wall to the center of the wall, or we're talking about excluding the wall, or we're talking about including the wall. So you can see where different interpretive decisions will affect how you understand this, but it does give us a pretty good idea of what this building looked like. Kind of the same today when you're measuring out a wall to put the studs in. We say it's framed either on a 16-inch or a 19.2-inch or 24-inch for the studs. Well, that means to the center of the stud. Except in certain circumstances, at the end of a wall, you measure all the way to the end of the stud. So there, you're all the way on the end of the stud, but everyone in between had better be on the center of the stud or your drywall doesn't fit. They understood what they were talking about a lot better than we do. So the people in Solomon's time would have been able to take these descriptions and accurately picture or reproduce even the building. We have a little harder time with it. So understand those little caveats as we get into the description of the text here. First Kings chapter 6. We covered up through about verse 13, 11, 12, and 13, God's promise to Solomon. That you're constructing this temple, it's a good thing, Israel needs this temple, but don't think for a moment that just because you have this temple means that you are all safe and covered, because he's going to encourage them concerning this house that you are building. Verse 12, if you will walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments and walk in them, then I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to your father David, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. He takes them back to the covenant. Take them back to the Mosaic law. That's the agreement by which Israel lives in the land. And so I think on one hand, God gave Solomon this word of the Lord to confirm to him that what he's doing is a good thing and that God does approve of the building of this temple, but also to encourage him that just because the temple exists doesn't mean that God is automatically going to pour out his blessing upon the people. It's, remember, never about forms. It's never about the ceremonies. It is about our relationship with God. And he's reminding Solomon, I don't need this house. You need me here. All right? We looked at the conception of the nations around Israel and how they looked at their gods. And they really did conceive of the temples as places where their gods could come and rest and recuperate their strength and have their needs ministered to by their worshipers. All of those ideas are thrown out the window when you come to the biblical conception of God. Never once does he let us begin to think that he needs us. We don't have to minister to his needs. He doesn't have any. We don't have to provide him food so that he can be strengthened and energized. He has no limit on his supply of energy. Right? And so there are some very strong distinctions to be made in the construction of this temple. And so I think God is helping Solomon understand, just because this temple is here, just because you're going to build this, doesn't mean that I am going to bless you. You have to keep going back to the covenant. That's the terms. That's how you relate to me. Go back to my word and what I've told you. So if you guys start to disobey my covenant, you start to break my commandments, I will kick you out of the land, even though there's a temple here. So just because you have the temple is not this guarantee that I'm going to protect you from everything. You need to stay faithful to the covenant. So the first 12 verses of chapter 6 describe for us the temple in general. They give us the rough dimensions of it. They tell us roughly what it looked like. Now he's going to turn his attention to the interior decorations. What did the temple look like in its finished state? We might call the first half of the chapter the rough building and the second part of the chapter the finished building. When I was doing construction work, I kind of varied all over the place. I could do framing and plumbing and electrical and all those things, but I was a little better at the finish work than I am at the rough stuff. I know guys that can frame up entire houses in a couple of days because they're just quick at it, and I could never quite accomplish that. So I was always a little better at the finish material, so I like the second half better than the first half, right? So, but we're going to look at some finish details of the temple. Verse 14, so Solomon built the house and finished it. He lined the walls of the house on the inside with boards of cedar. So we talked at last time about how this house was built of stone that was cut at the quarry. And I want to clarify a little bit. Kim told me I made it sound like they just broke the rock off in perfect shapes already, which is not necessarily the case. They could mine the rock very accurately, but they did still use some shaping tools on them to get them just the right dimensions and just the right shape and smoothness. Eldon. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, sandstone in the earth can be very soft. You ever seen pictures of the Grand Canyon with the folds in the rock layers? I mean, that's because that stuff was soft at one point, and it just bent. It didn't crack. So once you bring it out and expose it to air, it starts hardening almost like concrete. But probably this temple was built out of white limestone. But that it also can come out somewhat soft, and it's also a little bit workable. But they would scrape it with something like a drawing knife. Sort of look like that, and then they could plane the sides of the thing and get it nice and smooth and square. So you can imagine in the structure this size, each block has to be very carefully shaped to make sure that it's going to sit on top of one another. You have millions of pounds of rock being stacked on top of each other, so the rock below it has to support that kind of weight. It's an endeavor. We look at the buildings of the ancient peoples, and some of it is still a little bit of an enigma to us. We're not quite sure how they did it. We're going to see some of that a little bit later on, too. So the walls of the temple are constructed out of this stone that was quarried and then brought to the temple complex. We also know that Solomon flattened out Mount Moriah with a porch and with retaining walls. In fact, there's some excavations that have gone on in recent years that have shown the Wailing Wall that's there in Jerusalem now may actually date back to Solomon's time and not to Herod's time, the way they constructed that wall. Those are actually retaining stones. Kind of, if you've seen the pictures of the Jews praying at the Wailing Wall and they're putting little pieces of paper in it, some of those stones are grooved so that they interlock each other and can support the weight of all that earth and retain it back. So part of that may have been part of Solomon's construction. But Solomon flattened out the temple complex because, of course, Mount Moriah is very, very bumpy. But he flattened it all out and created this big patio place where he could construct both the temple and the outer court buildings, okay? Because you need a big flat space to build this thing. So when he's putting up the walls of stone, and it says that the roof was beams of cedar with other woods overlaid top of it, now we get inside and say, he lined the walls of the house on the inside with boards of cedar. From the floor of the house to the walls of the ceiling, he covered them on the inside with wood, and he covered the floor of the house with boards of cypress. He's completely paneled the inside of this temple building, and he's going to tell us here in just a couple of verses that there's no stone seen inside the temple. Outside the temple, it would be a stone structure, but when you walked inside, there was no stone seen. It was completely paneled with choicely cut boards. Now, Dan, you need a plank of wood, and all you have are trees. How are you going to turn that into planks? You're going to hire a sawmill to come in with a big bandsaw, right? Yes, and you're going to rip that thing into planks, all right? Nope, sorry, can't do it. No electricity in Lebanon, right? So Solomon's contracted with Hiram to bring all this lumber down from Lebanon. But can you imagine trying to shape a board, shape a log into a plank with no power tools? I love woodworking and all, but I don't know, Dan, I might give up without power tools. Eldon?
Well, your school, they did it with
man. Yes. Isn't that fun? It is a lot of work, yeah. So, I mean, we can frame up houses now in a matter of a couple of days, a team of five guys, because we have pneumatic nail guns, we have electric tools, and now we even have cordless tools, so you don't have to haul that extension cord all over the place. The tools we have available have made work very easy on us, right? Think washing machines. How many of you are happy you have a washing machine rather than having to go out and beat your clothes on rocks until they're clean? Right. Dishwashers. Lifesaver in our house. Do you know how many dishes eight people generate in a day? Yeah. It's pretty much a load of dishes after every meal. So load the dishwasher up. We had a dishwasher when I was a kid. It was a Brian, Pam, and Mark model. Yeah. So I wash dishes every night. We wash dishes. Patricia?
Mm-hmm.
Was it one of those old tub with a ringer on it?
It had an agitator in, but I had the handle on the outside, and I was doing the agitation.
Okay, yep. Mm-hmm. And see, I complain, don't I? All right, if you were tired of my complaining, you can slap me after the service, all right? Yeah. Yep. Well, that about fits the era the building was built, doesn't it? But but we didn't do the next step on these panels. So, I mean, these also are not wood panels. We know that. That's not real wood. Those are plywood. But he's probably cutting planks that are several inches thick and paneling them on, fastening them to the wall. And so he's got the entire inside of the building covered with cypress. Verse 16, he built 20 cubits of the rear of the house with boards of cedar. From the floor to the walls, he built this within as an inner sanctuary, as the most holy place. So here he's describing the very back of the temple. If you can see back here, they've got a cutaway, and they have the picture of the two cherubim. This section of the temple, he's already told us, measured 20 cubits wide. Now he tells us it's 20 cubits deep as well, and he's going to tell us it's also 20 cubits tall. Perfect cube. That's an important piece of symbolism in the temple because of what this temple represents, okay? Which we'll get to here in just a moment. But this is the most holy place. In a lot of ways, this temple reflects the tabernacle. It's the same rough dimensions as the tabernacle, same design. There would have been the outer court of the priests, which is where the altar of burnt offering was, and the bronze lavers for washing your hands, and then that's where they would offer the sacrifices. Then the priest would bring the blood into the inner sanctuary, and that's this point here. If you can see the guy in blue, he's in the inner sanctuary, not the most holy place. This is where the menorah, the candelabra, was. This is where the table of showbread was at. This is where the altar of incense was. And so he would bring the blood in there and sprinkle it on the floor in front of the Holy of Holies, which was separated from the inner place by a curtain. This is all in the tabernacle, understand. That same design is going to be reflected in the temple. And back behind the curtain in the Holy of Holies was the Ark of the Covenant. That's where God dwelt. He dwelled in his glory on what was called the mercy seat, because that is the throne of God ruling over Israel from that ark. And the reason that the law was kept in there was because that was the standard by which God ruled his people Israel. So it's very powerful symbolism going on there in the construction of that tabernacle and in the construction of this temple. And so it's going to reflect that in a lot of ways. Okay? So there's this 20 by 20 by 20 cube in the back of the temple called the Holy of Holies, and that's where the Ark of the Covenant would go, and that's where God would sit on his throne and rule over Israel. And that brings us to the picture that this temple is. In the cultures around Israel, the temple was conceived of as a resting place for their God, where he could take a break from his duties of deity, from making the sun to shine and things, and he could come down and he could have his needs ministered to. But in the biblical picture, this temple is the throne room where God rules. It's a very different picture than what the nations around Israel had. And the reason that we constantly, under the Old Covenant, had to splatter blood in front of the Holy of Holies was to keep, was so that God would not have to leave the throne and visit his people in judgment, because the blood was there to cover all of our transgressions against his law. And so Jehovah was ruling his people from that throne of Israel. The patterns that are shown in the temple, which we're going to see there, of the cherubim around the throne and the palm branches and all of those things, are all reflective of scenes that we do see in the heavenly temple. Think of Isaiah chapter 6, when he appears before the Lord. I saw the Lord high and lifted up. The train of his robe filled the temple. And what was around him? Cherubim. These strange-looking creatures with multiple faces and wings and eyes all over them. Things that sort of blow our imaginations. Because God didn't create things like that to live visibly on this earth. They're too glorious. They dwell in heaven with him. And we don't see them. But we get a couple of glimpses into that heavenly throne room throughout Scripture, and this temple was meant to be a reflection of that, because God rules from heaven, rules everything, the entire cosmos, ruled from heaven in God's throne room where he sits. This temple is a reflection of that, where God can rule over his people. And so this was meant to look like a royal throne room, and God lives there. God dwells there. And all right, so this 20 by 20 by 20 cube, perfect cube. Incidentally, this just reminds me. Revelation chapter 21. What comes down from heaven? The New Jerusalem. What shape is it? A perfect cube. Okay. That's picturesque, isn't it? Don't get too wrapped up in numerology in the Bible, by the way. You hear some people are all constantly analyzing numbers in the Bible. Yeah, there are some important numbers in the Bible, but be careful with that stuff. But that picture of the cube does represent heaven connecting earth. And this throne room was a picture of that. God ruling both on earth and in heaven. Jesus reflects this as well as he teaches us to pray. If your kingdom come, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. We want you to rule here the way you rule there. And that's why this temple reflects that. Okay. So the where did I leave off there? End of verse 16 there. So verse 17, the house that is the nave in front of the inner sanctuary was 40 cubits long. So we know the entire structure was 60 cubits long. And the Holy of Holies was 20 cubits long. That leaves 40 cubits for what's called the inner sanctuary, this place where this little blue guy is, if you can see him there. So this is the inner sanctuary, and it's 40 cubits from end to end. Now, there's a porch on the front where these two pillars are at, and that's not included in that 40 cubits. This is another 10 cubits deep. So the Holy of Holies in the back here, 20 cubits long. The inner sanctuary, 40 cubits. The front porch, 10 cubits. Verse 18, the cedar within the house was carved in the form of gourds and open flowers, and all was cedar, no stone was seen. The inner sanctuary, he prepared in the innermost part of the house to set there the ark of the covenant of the Lord. The inner sanctuary was 20 cubits long, 20 cubits wide, 20 cubits high. Now he's going to tell us the next detail. Not only is it paneled with wood beams, but it is also covered in gold. He overlaid it with pure gold, and he also overlaid an altar of cedar. The entire inside of the sanctuary, both sanctuaries, the inner sanctuary and the outer sanctuary, covered in gold. Now, they didn't cover gold the way we do. We use, is it an electroplating something? We get pretty thin coats of gold. So, you know, if you have a gold-plated thing, there's not really a whole lot of gold on there, is there? Just try taking it to a pawn shop and saying, hey, this is gold. He'll say, not much. But that's, again, they don't have electricity in Solomon's day. Well, you know they actually might have. Do you know we've found little cups in Egypt that hold grape juice? And then the descriptions of them, they're putting two little things in them that if you put a zinc plate on one side and a copper plate on the other side, it generates electricity like a battery. Ever done that with potatoes? How many of you made a potato clock? You can stick wires in each end of the potato, and it'll generate an electric current. So there actually is potential that they knew what electricity was and how to use it, but probably not on the order that we've got now. But anyway, where was I going? I lost myself. Overlaying, that's right. So the way they would overlay was take the gold and hammer it into thin sheets, because gold, of course, is very pliable. Very soft. And so they would take a hammer and they would hammer it into very thin sheets, and then they would put it up on the wood and they would hammer it down until it matched the surface of the wood, and then they would tack it in with pins. And that's how they would overlay it. So not only do we have these panels of wood in there, but they're also carved with the shapes of, where do you say that? Verse 18, he says it's carved in the form of gourds and open flowers, and there's palm trees. So he has all these carvings in the wood, and then you're going to overlay that with gold. So you would take your hammer with a sheet of gold and start tacking it down until it formed the shape of all your carvings on there. You can understand this is a laborious process. This takes a very long time. This is how they would cover their gold idols. This is how they would cover anything that they wanted overlaid with gold. The Ark of the Covenant was a wooden box overlaid with gold. Okay, many of the implements in the temple were overlaid with gold. The cherubim that are back in the Holy of Holies, they're overlaid with gold. But the entire inner sanctuary overlaid with gold. So we can understand why when David was commissioning Solomon and telling him to build a temple, he talked about how much gold he had laid aside for this thing. This is why. It took massive amounts of gold to be able to build this temple. It's also why in the future we're going to see that any time an invading king came in, one thing they loved to do was go in and strip the gold off the temple, because there's a lot of it in there. All right. So verse 21, and Solomon overlaid the inside of the house with pure gold, and he drew chains of gold across in front of the inner sanctuary and overlaid it with gold. So you have a golden chain crossing right in front of the Holy of Holy places. Why might that be? You're not allowed in there. Who's allowed in there? How often? One day a year, but nobody else gets in. Why? That's true. That is why, that's when he does the sacrifice for the nation, Day of Atonement, extremely important feast. Why was nobody else allowed in there? I mean, why is God so unapproachable? That is true. Jesus bridged the gap. That is why when the gospel writers tell us that Jesus died and that curtain was torn in two, that is such a small little detail in the gospels, but so important. When Paul tells us in Colossians that we are in Ephesians that we have been reconciled to God, That way is made open. Hebrews talks about this, that we now can come boldly before the throne of grace. There's no more chain. There's no more door there. There's no curtain anymore. Our approach to God is completely open because of Jesus, because he died for us. That ought to make every one of us stop and praise the Lord and sing songs to him and pray to him and sing his praises among people. Because this temple is obsolete. As glorious as it was, it's now obsolete. Okay. So there's this chain in front of the temple. Verse 22, he overlaid the whole house with gold until all the house was finished, and also the whole altar that belonged to the inner sanctuary he overlaid with gold. So we know that the temple stood 30 cubits tall. Well, if the inner sanctuary is 20 cubits by 20 cubits by 20 cubits, that leaves 10 cubits. And so he's talking about an altar in the inner sanctuary, and it's very possible, though the language is not precise enough to us to nail this down specifically, it's possible that there was a stairway so that the Holy of Holies sat up instead of on the same level. And that also would be very picturesque, that you're approaching God, you're approaching somebody greater than you are. Throne rooms still do this today. We put the throne up on a dais because we want everybody approaching that dais to be intimidated by the power and authority of the person sitting upon it. So there could be a couple of steps going up, and I think they show that here in this picture. In the inner sanctuary, he made two cherubim of olive wood, each 10 cubits high. 5 cubits was the length of one wing of the cherub, and 5 cubits the length of the other wing of the cherub. And it was 10 cubits from the tip of one wing to the tip of the other wing, to the tip of the other. So you have these cherubim, and they're standing there with their wings spread out, and from wingtip to wingtip, they're 10 cubits across. You know, I think this just answered for me whether the measurements were inclusive of the walls or not, because if it includes the really thick stone walls, how do you get 20 cubits inside unless the inside is actually 20 cubits? So we must be talking about the inner measurements. There you go. Don't you love when God explains himself? A cubit is about 18 inches. It was technically the distance from your elbow to your fingertip, but obviously my elbow to my fingertip are going to be different than yours, so there was a royal standard that was about 18 inches. So we're talking about a cube 30 feet by 30 feet by 30 feet. Okay? So these cherubim, they stand 15 feet across. That's pretty big. They'd be a very impressive thing to see, especially since they also are overlaid with gold. And verse 25, the other cherub also measured 10 cubits, and both cherubim had the same measure and the same form. The height of one was 10 cubits, and so was that of the other. So here are these statues of these cherub standing guard over the Ark of the Covenant in the inner sanctuary, just like in the heavenly throne room. When Isaiah saw it, there were the cherubim and the seraphs flying around that throne, and so they pictured this in the temple in Jerusalem. So they're 10 cubits tall, so it's about 15 feet tall, and they stand 15 feet wide. He put the cherubim in the innermost part of the house, that's the Holy of Holies, the inner sanctuary. And the wings of the cherubim were spread out so that a wing of one touched the one wall, and a wing of the other cherub touched the other wall, and their wings touched each other in the middle of the house. And he overlaid the cherubim with gold. Around the walls of the house, he carved engraved figures of cherubim and plants, or palm trees and open flowers in the inner and the outer rooms. So not only in the Holy of Holies, but also out in the other part of the sanctuary, there are these carvings all over the walls. The floor of the house he overlaid with gold in the inner and outer rooms. Remember the description of the streets in the heavenly Jerusalem? What are they made out of? Gold. What are the gates made out of? Pearls and precious stones. It's going to be a glorious place, and this temple was built to reflect the greatness, the majesty, the splendor of heaven. And it was meant to mirror that as much as is earthly possible. So, he's got all these carvings, he has them overlaid with gold. Verse 31, "For the entrance to the inner sanctuary, he made doors of olive wood. The lintel and the doorposts were five-sided." There's a little bit of trouble interpreting the Hebrew wording here, but roughly it means that probably the doors occupied one-fifth of the opening. And so the doors here going into the inner sanctuary, made of olive wood, occupied a fifth of the 20 cubits. So they'd be 4 cubits wide. So you had this door going into where the ark rested. Not only is there a curtain, but there's a door and there's chains. Get the picture? You're not allowed in here. Okay. Yeah. If you didn't get the hint, if the chains don't tell you, the curtains should tell you. If the curtain doesn't tell you, the doors should tell you. You're not supposed to be in here. There's these doors that are probably 4 cubits wide, and they guard the way into the Holy of Holies. He covered the two doors of olive wood with carvings of cherubim, palm trees, and open flowers, and he overlaid them with gold and spread gold on the cherubim and on the palm trees. Verse 33, "So also he made for the entrance to the nave doorposts of olive wood in the form of a square, and two doors of cypress wood. The two leaves of the one door were folding, and the two leaves of the other door were folding." So we're not talking about one big door panel or two big door panels that push open. They were folding doors. How many of you have bifold doors in your house for your closets or something? Picture something like that. So the doors going into the sanctuary don't just swing out, they push to the side. And that's a pretty complex operation for doors of that size because all of the weight gets transferred. It's tough to hold them up, and especially when they're covered with gold. You ever tried to hang doors? I mean, you have to put some pretty good screws in the hinge of a door because the weight, especially of a steel entry door, is kind of heavy. So you need to have some pretty beefy screws to hold them in place. Now, can you imagine taking that steel door, multiplying it by about 10 times, and covering it with gold? These things were heavy. The engineering that it took to design all this stuff was extreme. But it's also very, very fancy. Two doors. Yeah, okay. Verse 35. "On them he carved cherubim, palm trees, open flowers, overlaid them with gold, evenly applied on the carved work. He built the inner court with 3 courses of cut stone and 1 course of cedar beams." Here, we're talking about a different thing. He's just described the interior decorations of the sanctuary and the Holy of Holies. That's the temple proper. Now we're coming outside where there would have been the courtyard. In the courtyard would have been the bronze altar for burnt offerings, the lavers for washing. You can see both of those things on our picture here. And surrounding that courtyard, which was called the courtyard of the priests, he describes this low stone wall. It's only made of 3 courses of stone. So it's not tall enough that you can't see what's going on in the priest's courtyard. This is a barrier to any of the normal people, not Levites, not priests. If you were not a Levite, you were not allowed to go into to that courtyard. Your worship was, you brought your sheep to the barrier, you gave it to a priest, you laid your hands on it, confessed your sins, he took it, and then he would go in and would sacrifice the animal for you. You could watch it, but you couldn't go in. And that's what this low wall is. Think something like a half-height wall, maybe a little taller, but it's got 3 courses of stone, and on top it's got a wooden banister, a wooden rail. And so that's the barrier that kept the average Israelite out of there. And so he built the inner court. So, verse 37, we come back to timing. In the 4th year, the foundation of the house of the Lord was built in the month of Ziv. The month of Ziv is the 2nd month of the year, which starts, first month of the year is in April, usually March or April, depending on the calendar. You understand the Hebrew calendar is built on a solar year, or sorry, not a solar year, on a lunar year. Of 12 months of 30 days. So what happens in 12 months of 30 days compared to the solar year? you're behind. 5.5 days or 5.25 days, right? So the Hebrew calendar would also add a 13th month every so often to make up the lost days. And so they measured their year by the harvest. When a certain harvest wasn't at a certain point by a certain point in the year, you got an extra month. Sort of like our leap year, but not nearly as regular. And so the second month of the year would have been March or April. That's when they began their new year. I'm sorry, the second month of the year would have been like April, May. That's the time when you start building projects. You don't start them in the dead of winter, because our winter here, you can't build much in the winter because it's cold, the ground is frozen, it's hard to pour concrete, it's hard to get nails to go in, stuff like that. In Israel, it's very wet. So winter is their rainy season. It does get cold outside, but it's their wet season, so it's very hard to build. So as soon as the spring came, they started work on this temple and they laid the foundation. Now probably at that point, the land had already been flattened out. David may have even begun that project of building the retaining walls and leveling out Mount Zion, getting it ready. Solomon's work was building the temple, the temple proper. So we're talking about laying the foundation stones for the temple proper, okay? So he starts it in the fourth year of his reign, on the second month of the year. Verse 38, and in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, which is the 8th month, the house was finished in all its parts, and according to all its specifications. So you can do some math here. He starts in the 4th year of his reign on the 2nd month. He ends in the 11th year of his reign on the 8th month. How long did it take him to build the temple? Yeah, about 7.5 years. We have it listed for us in a round number here. He was 7 years in building it. 7 years building this temple. So if he began the construction of the temple sometime around 1015 BC, I'm sorry, let me back up. If Solomon became king and was coronated sometime around 1015 BC, that means the temple construction begins in about 1011 BC. And that means the temple is completed sometime in 1003 BC, 7.5 years later. It's a huge building project. Most churches, most church people probably wouldn't tolerate a building project of 7 years, right? We want it done now. the company I did a lot of work for, they had their house building process down. They could build a house in 47 days from start to finish. That's from the time you sign the paper to the time you move in. So pouring the foundation, digging it, everything done, 47 days. And they had a lot of nervous breakdowns while they were at it, because that's fast. And if things don't go exactly according to plan, well, then that throws everything off. But 7.5 years Solomon is building this. And we can kind of understand why it took so long, because of the ornate design in this building. We don't know how much of it David prepared ahead of time. David tells Solomon that he prepared a lot of the wood and the stone and the gold and things that were necessary. So David may have had some of these things ready already. And we have to keep that in mind, because the next chapter we're going to read about Solomon building his palace. And one of the first things you'll notice is that he spent more time on his own palace than he did on the house of the Lord. That's not necessarily because he was less interested in the temple, okay? It might be because David was so interested in the temple that he got a lot of things prepared ahead of time. So as we finish there, chapter 6, a house like no other, any questions or comments? Gene?
Is